The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Merry Easter! I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his evil nemesis, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 52 of The Big Picture for the week beginning March 27. And coming up on today's show, we've got pandas.
Pandas, anyone?
Yep, Jack Black and Poe are both back.
We're also hunting terrorists with Helen Mirren.
And if that wasn't enough, we have the showdown of the millennia, Batman versus Superman.
All of that coming up on today's episode of Mark The Big Picture. Very great to see you on this Easter Sunday. How are you going?
I'm pretty happy. A pretty bit hyped, a bit too much chocolate, to be honest. I'm probably vibrating in my seat.
We talked about this before the show, Mark.
I know. Diabetic, too much chocolate. Who would have thought?
Mate, you always overindulge on Easter Sunday. Before we get to talking about Kung Fu Panda 3, one of the big releases out this week, let's do a little bit of a wrap-up of also what's going on this week around the place. On Blu-ray and DVD, Mark, you already would be aware that Call the Midwife Seasons 1 to 5 Plus, the Christmas specials, are now all available. And I'm basically just saying that because my wife, Amy, loves that show.
I knew it.
Wherever I can get a plug in about my wife, I do. And she will definitely be asking me to go out and get that box set.
If you don't get somebody to send it to you. Okay, well, on TV, it's far less interesting. Let's say on the Nine Network's My House Rules knockoff, Reno Rumble has started. So it's back in force, running 7:30 to 9 on Tuesdays to Thursdays. If you want to see some builders going berserk who aren't in your street, well, you can tune in. And so last week, the 7 Network responded in kind with... last year, the 7 Network actually played a bit of a spoiler game and responded in kind with their own building show at the same time. But instead, this time, they've got their households doing something else entirely in the 7-year switch, troubled couples trying out new husbands and wives. Yeesh. More on that in our review show next week when we talk to one of the show's psychologists involved in keeping those poor couples sane.
And I'll also be talking about that show, The 7-Year Switch. Stay tuned. Also out on DVD and Blu-ray and the like this week, Mark, is a film called Captive, which neither of us have seen, and actually most people haven't because it didn't make cinemas here, but it's a very intriguing film. It stars the Selma star David Oyelowo, I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Well done for
Oyelowo,
trying.
And the Martian's Kate Mara, and it's based on a true story of an escaped convict who takes a woman hostage, and then somehow Rick Warren's very famous book, The Purpose-Driven Life, helps them out in this tense situation. And that's a movie called Captive. I'm intrigued. It didn't go very well at cinemas in the States, but I am still intrigued by this proposition.
Okay. Well, fancy a bit of British crime. The Last Panthers begins this week on SBS. It's a complex thriller about a dual heist gang that terrorised Europe, then went quiet and only suddenly to emerge about a decade later. Look, the thing that interests me the most about this is John Hurt is involved.
I saw him in the trailer and I instantly marked it down as I want to watch that.
Yes, kicking off this Thursday at 8:30 p.m. on SBS2.
Mark, in entertainment news this week, not only is it Easter Sunday, but it's also my 40th birthday.
Entertainment news indeed.
It is. That's not even a joke. There's nothing to that. It's my 40th birthday. I don't want to overshadow the resurrection of Jesus and the celebration of that, but it is my 40th birthday.
I do believe there is a humorous side to it, given the fact that the T-shirts you're still wearing at 40. Moving on. That little film called Zootopia.
Thanks for the present, mate.
That little film called Zootopia we reviewed last week. Well, it's eating up the box office in the US, ranking 3 weeks in the number one position and earning $204 million in America alone.
But whoa.
The dream is likely to come to an end this week, I think, because we see the release of Heavyweights Kung Fu Panda 3 and Batman vs. Superman. Stay tuned for both later in the show.
All being reviewed in the show. Before we get to Kung Fu Panda 3, though, Mark, I've got a true or false proposition.
Oh, I love this
for
bit.
You love this, it's part fun. Of the show because it's Easter Sunday. We thought we'd throw a Jesus reference in at this point. So Cliff Curtis, the actor who played Jesus in the recent film Risen, that was at cinemas, he lived by himself for a month in order to prepare for this Messiah role. True or false?
Where did he live by himself in a month?
I'm not sure that's part of the true or false, Mark. The purpose of this question is...
how would you prepare if you're living for a month
by a lake? Back with me after your Kung Fu Panda 3 review and let me know whether you think that's true or false.
I will.
It's been 8 years. 8 years.
I know.
Since the overweight panda Poe stumbled onto the big screen, ready to face down down evil and falling flat on his face as he did it. But still managing to become one of the biggest hits for the family at cinemas in the process. Jack Black is back this week as the furry dragon warrior in Kung Fu Panda 3. And mixed in with his determined take on the Eastern arts is some rather lazy Western philosophy for the flabby mind.
You must take the next step on your journey from warrior to teacher.
But I'm no good at it.
Oh no! It's the dragon teacher! He's so handsome! What
the? Paul?
Oh, hey, Dad. What's up?
You're terrible at it.
Who are you?
I'm looking for my son.
Dad?
Give your old man a hug!
They always used to say in scriptwriting school, if you're not sure what to do, introduce a new character.
And they do this in this movie?
They do it multiple times. In Kung Fu Panda 3, we kick off in the spirit realm where Master Oogway is, you know, you might remember him as this super subtle turtle, relaxing in his dotage. He comes across his old student and enemy Kai, a yak who's been stealing chi, which is apparently life force, of all the great masters so that he can, well, I'm actually not quite sure why he's stealing all the chi, and I did see the film. Anyway, he's bad. Let's just face
What's
it.
What's the chi again? Like the energy?
The life force.
The Eastern philosophy life force
idea? It's actually power. Kai heads back into the real world because there's not much going on now that he's stolen all the chi in the spirit realm.
Yes.
And he's off to face the dragon warrior Po. But meantime, Po is being busied with the reunification of his life as his actual father, his biological father, turns up. And now there's this whole sort of father situation between his duck father and his panda father.
And then
a whole village of mystical secret pandas turn up. And when Kai comes calling, Po has to rely on everything he's learnt and his newfound family to master the secret of chi or become another trophy on Kai's belt. So,
man, how does this stack up? I'm a guy who loved the first Kung Fu Panda. I gave it 5 stars when I was reviewing for Empire. I went and saw it twice. I loved it so much.
And so you should have.
And the second one, I don't really remember that well. I think I was a little bit disappointed. How's the third one go?
Yeah, this one, look, okay, if you were just looking at the box office, it's tracking exactly as you'd expect because Kung Fu Panda 1 was like a monolith. It turned out 600 million plus. So too, Kung Fu Panda 2. And if you're looking for similar first weekend results, it's doing exactly the same business. Kung Fu Panda 3 should sit in the same territory. Strangely, though, that's possibly because there's just nothing new. I mean, it's very much the find yourself struggle of Kung Fu Panda 1.
And often we as audiences, as much as we say we don't, we do like the same old thing time and again. We like to go back for exactly what we had before.
So much so that Kung Fu Panda 3 decided to include the plotline of Kung Fu Panda 2 as well.
Hey, it was good the first time around and it worked. Thousands
so
before that.
Not only are you finding yourself, but you're finding your family as well. There are no surprises, which is pretty much, it means that like most kids, they'll probably just like it.
So now we're at the third installment of the Kung Fu Panda franchise. Are you still a fan of this franchise overall? I know you really liked the first one that you just mentioned, the second one not so much, but it sounds like you're starting to taper off.
Well, I mean, kids are amazing insofar as they're quite happy to see the same. I see my boys watch the same episodes of a program they like over and over again. So, you know, in that respect, I don't think kids are going to be disappointed. And there are some great things. Po's not ashamed of his shape. I always think that that is a great thing, you know, to be showing kids. Like, he's round when, you know, as opposed to not some streamlined rabbit or, you know, coyote or something like that. Okay. He's not afraid of having different solutions to problems than others. So his kung fu style is very much about bouncing all over the place and crashing into people. He's from a mixed family, which is kind of an interesting thing for this day and age. Okay. He's an adopted kid, if you like, and he's got a dad who's of a different race. So that's not a bad thing. I like to see that too. But on the negative side, there's so much sophistry. That's like clever sounding sayings that mean nothing. Okay?
Yeah, is that what sophistry means?
There you go. I have just educated you and
on
the rest of the audience.
On my 40th birthday. Thank you very much. My gift to you.
You know, stuff like the more you take, the less you have.
Sure. Okay, yeah, right.
Or if you only do what you can do, you will never be more than what you are today. Which kind of sounds wise, but means nothing, really.
Yeah. So, you know. So is this safe territory for the whole family to go along to? It is rated PG?
Yeah, no. Now, the weird thing is, okay, this is one of those cases where parents would go, okay, same for everything that's come along. The kids loved Kung Fu Panda. I would be a little more cautious with the third one, okay, because sure, there's a lot of Eastern philosophy and religious symbolism in there, and often parents get, you know, are worried about that. Christian parents are particularly concerned if they're going to show their kids a lot of stuff with, you know, obviously in other religions content in it. Okay, but that's not actually the biggest danger here. The real danger lies in the Western philosophies that have been buried in it. See, the chi in this plot is pretty much acting the same way as the force, okay, in Star Wars or something like that. And so the whole idea is, how are you going to master Chi? Well, the secret, apparently, to mastering Chi is being who you were truly meant to be, which is just accepting everything about yourself and being content that you're great.
Right, no matter what.
Now, that has got to be the laziest Western philosophy I have ever heard, which is just basically like, integrate everything about yourself, accept every corner and angle of yourself, and that's fine, which is easygoing and fantastic for overweight pandas and lazy Westerners. You know, it requires nothing of you except to accept yourself, which turns out to be incredibly powerful, apparently, if you do that, and then you're, you know, on top of everything, there's no improvement to be made. And so I sort of feel like this is actually not, you don't have to worry about the Buddhism. This is actually Western Buddhism, which is, you know, just be very, very happy and very, very at peace and you'll be fine, which, as we know as Christians, is pretty much the quickest way down rather than up.
Kung Fu Panda 3 kicked its way into cinemas last Thursday, March 24, earning a PG rating for itself for mild animated fantasy violence with a side order of apathetic philosophy, according to Mark. It stars the voice of Jack Black, Angelina Jolie, Seth Rogen, Bryan Cranston.
Yes, he makes an appearance.
And J.K. Simmons are all in this film. There's also a special appearance by Jean-Claude Van Damme, of course there is, in Kung Fu Panda 3. Now, Mark, before we talked all things Kung Fu and Panda, I put to you a true or false question, which is, or which was, and still is, Cliff Curtis, who played Jesus in Risen, that was at cinemas recently, lived by himself for a month in order to prepare for that role. True or false?
Now, I'm going to go with true because he already lived by himself. How's that? No?
No, it was true, but he didn't already live by himself. He had to leave his, he left his wife somewhere,
oh,
apparently.
Gosh.
He went off and lived in Malta for a month. It was a really beautiful experience, according to Cliff Curtis. I had very humble meals, and I lived monastically pretty much for a month to get into the mindset of Jesus.
What is pretty much when it comes to monastic living? You just only look at your phone every 5
monastic,
minutes?
Mildly monastic?
Mildly monastic. I'm mildly monastic.
Mate, what's coming up in the rest of the show?
Well, mate, we've got heaps of stuff coming up. Look, Eye in the Sky with Helen Mirren. If you're actually a Helen Mirren fan, you can be very pleased with the film we're talking about. And the huge thing to be talking about this week is obviously Batman versus Superman.
Welcome back to this special Easter Sunday edition of The Big Picture. Still to come on the program, we're going to be talking about everything from Batman versus Superman to, Mark, if you can believe this, the top 5 Jesus appearances on screen.
And a special award to people who can tell us what is the appropriate plural of Jesus.
We have been trying to work that out. You were saying Jesus.
I don't know.
Jesus.
This is not meant to be disrespectful. We're just not Greek scholars.
No, we just
hang
wrestle.
Hang on a second, you are a Greek scholar.
I'm not a Greek scholar. We just like to wrestle with the big problems, the big questions here. On The Big Picture, Mark.
Well, look, let's move on because that question is far too big. Okay, so today's soundtrack choice, we're up to soundtrack, was that part of the show where we actually like to delve into the music behind the films. Today's soundtrack choice should be staggeringly familiar for our posse of panda fans out there. It's a one-hit wonder by Carl Douglas, which will become more interesting later, that was released as a single on the cusp of a whole bunch of chop-socky film crazes that eventually helped rise this sort of release to the top of the British and American charts. Actually, it eventually went on to sell 11 million records worldwide, making it one of the best-selling singles of all time. So you'd expect some sort of quintessential popularity and value in this. It is basically an opportunity for you to release your inner Bruce Lee because it's the theme song of all 3 Kung Fu Panda films. It's, of course, 1974's Kung Fu Fighting. Oh, ho, ho.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But they fought with expert timing. There were funky China men from funky Chinatown. They were chopping them up. They were chopping them down. It's an ancient Chinese art. And everybody
Here comes the big boss. Hey. Hey. Let's get it. Took a bow and made a stand. Started swaying with the hand. Sudden motion made me skip. Now we're into a brand new trip. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those cats were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. But they did it with expert timing. Oh, yeah. Oh, 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 oh.
Our first Now showing choice this week is Eye in the Sky, a war movie with a difference. Starring Helen Mirren, Aaron Paul, and Alan Rickman in his final screen performance, this heat of battle drama targets the ethics of combat and collateral damage in the overly digitized and roboticized era of the 21st century, where generals and politicians can order mass destruction from a very safe distance. Is it ever okay to kill someone if you could save many other lives in the process? And would a Christian answer that question differently than Eye in the Sky?
This is Colonel Powell. She's going to walk you through the capture of Aisha Al-Hadi, aka Susan Danford.
We have intelligence of a meeting between Danford and numbers 4 and 5 on our most wanted list.
We believe that they're connected to the recent suicide bombing in Kenya.
We have information that they will be in this house today. This is an operation to capture, not kill.
Range, 22,000 feet.
You have your orders, Lieutenant. Your job is to be their eye in the sky.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Mark. Helen Mirren's playing this British colonel called Colonel Powell, and she's orchestrating this international mission to basically bomb a bunch of terrorists in Nairobi in Kenya. The backdrop of this story is based on the real event in 2013 in a shopping mall in Kenya, where a group of terrorists, extreme Islamic terrorists, took a lot of hostages. And so from that, Eye in the Sky is a fictional account of then the international response to getting the people that were behind.
Very much based in fact, is what
that's
you're
right.
Saying,
very yeah. much based in fact, and for a lot of the movie, you're getting scenes of government and political leaders sitting around tables in England, in America, and also in Kenya. But it's primarily England and America that are talking about what's going on, and there's a lot of conversation about whether they will or they won't go through with the mission that Helen Mirren's character is heading up.
Wow. Now, I've got my mother-in-law in mind when I ask this first question, because she's a huge Helen Mirren fan, but she's not very tolerant of explosive gun-toting plots. Should someone watch this if they don't like war movies?
I think so, yes. Maybe not so much your mother-in-law.
Because she's feisty.
Yeah,
she's feisty. She will take you to task.
I think it's a war movie for people who don't normally like war movies, even though it's a war movie. But the main difference I see with it in comparison with many other films, not just that you don't see much of actual combat, it's talking about combat and you're sort of looking through down the sights, at those who are being targeted and what might actually occur if a drone missile strike happens, as is what's going on in Eye in the Sky. But that's about as close as you get. Rather than that, what you're seeing is all the choices that are going on behind the scenes of how people in positions of power, with the power that they wield, how are they going to go about deciding what they're actually going to do? And one of the things I loved about Eye in the Sky, I was a big fan of this, I was really quite gripped by how tense a film this became, is that For something as quite fresh, for want of a better word, as drone warfare is, the fact that this film goes into the ethics, not just of drone warfare, but of warfare itself, the minefield of morality that comes from this kind of conflict, I think is quite incredible. And the multifaceted angles you get from Eye in the Sky, I think, make this a war movie for even those who hate war movies.
Yeah, so it seems pretty clear that the basic thrust is to save many people. Is it worth sacrificing the life of one person? And, you know, as Christian reviewers, I'm starting to think, is this where we're going to start talking about Jesus?
It is,
you know?
Easter Sunday, Mark, well, after
one,
all.
One life for many.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It does make you instantly think of Jesus as a Christian. But no, this isn't the point in our show, and it shouldn't be the point for viewers either, I don't think, when you're watching it, to think, great, I'm just going to cram Jesus in here. That's not really what the film's trying to get at. It's not trying to suggest that one should stand up for all. It's more that question behind that question, which is that ever right to be able to do that? And in this case, Eye in the Sky is more tense, and this isn't giving something away. No, it's not giving too much away. It's in the trailer. What the catalyst is in this film is being when the terrorists are being targeted outside the safe house that they're in, so-called safe house, there's a little girl selling bread. And so will these political government leaders shoot down a house in Kenya, knowing full well that the high probability is they will kill this little girl, let alone other people, collateral damage, as it's called, that they'll actually do that? Will they do that? Will they go through with that? So the question is more about if you have the power to sacrifice someone else's life to potentially save the lives of others, because these terrorists are planning another suicide mission. We get to see that in Eye in the Sky. So that will potentially kill many other people. And in a week where we've seen the tragic events in Brussels, what you see up in screen in Eye in the Sky, again, is seeming to be suggesting a very real presentation of the kind of sacrifices and the questions around those sacrifices that are made by people in these positions of power in real life.
And do we have the right to choose?
Yes.
Okay, well, so how does a Christian then go about navigating the ethical minefield of Eye in the Sky?
That's a really great question, and that's the main thing I was like puzzling over as I was watching this. I should also mention the cast in this is fantastic. It's the last final performance on screen by Alan Rickman.
Yeah, look, I would tick it off to watch.
I think a lot of people are going to show up for that. And also stars Breaking Bad's Aaron Paul as the drone pilot who has big major reservations about the mission that he's on.
Jesse Pinkman gets a shot
in this movie. So the cast is great, and the director Gavin Hood has done a fantastic job, I think, here of showing modern warfare. How should a Christian think about this, or how would anyone go about thinking about this? If you step back and think about any situation in your life and the choices that you have to make, whether it be in a drone strike or anything else, life is more complicated than we often like to admit. And so now we jump to the Christian part. I think Christians sometimes themselves can paint lives a little bit too narrowly. Like, there's really easy choices to make. Things are black and white. Now, there are loads of black and white, but there's also a lot of gray. When you're watching Eye in the Sky, if you're going to save this little girl's life or save other people's lives, which is the more loving act to do? And if Jesus calls us to love our neighbor and love our enemy, what do we do in that situation? Like, who is our enemy? Who is our neighbor? And how do you go about loving them in this situation? How do you demonstrate mercy and compassion, forgiveness even in this situation, yet justice as well? And how do we uphold the authority figures around us? How do we relate to positions of power? All those kinds of things. It reminded me of a book that I read Bible College a couple of years ago. One of my lecturers, in a very shameless plug for his own book, his name's Andrew Cameron. He's an excellent ethics lecturer. He wrote a book called The Joined Up Life, and it's his understanding of how Christianity draws together an ethical framework for our lives. And the point of The Joined Up Life is what it says in the title, which is you've got to connect all of these strands of Jesus' teaching and guidance, let alone all of the Bible's guidance that it gives us, and pull that together to make our decisions, not just try to cherry pick one particular statement or another and wield it in a particular situation. And Eye in the Sky dredged all that up for me and pointed to, as a Christian, what I should be looking for is joining together all of my Christianity to make my decisions, not just like going off half-cocked or, you know, making a rash decision.
Or simplifying.
And Eye in the Sky definitely doesn't do that. It's a great, great film. I highly recommend it. Very intense and engaging.
Okay, so watch Eye in the Sky, read The Joined Up Life.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Eye in the Sky opened this week at cinemas and is rated M for mature themes, violence, and coarse language. No surprises, I guess. It stars Helen Mirren in Army Fatigues, Alan Rickman, and Jesse Pinkman. Well, actually, the actor who played Jesse Pinkman in the cult TV series Breaking Bad, Aaron Paul.
Now, Mark, as much as I'm a 50, I'm 40 today. I was like jumping ahead of myself, but we turned 50 a couple of weeks ago.
We did.
Which means that we're up to, what, about episode 52 of the show?
This 53? Is episode 52.
52, that's right, which means we've got 51 past episodes back on the bigpicturewebsite.com. Go and check it out. And also you can find us on Facebook and Twitter during the week where we upload the latest edition of the show when this comes out as a podcast or as videos. That's what we do. That's how we roll online.
Yes, and actually if you're looking for other stuff online that's really worth checking out, check out Eternity. Eternity is one of the big supporters of our show, the Bible Society's national publication, Eternity. There you'll actually find Ben's review of Eye in the Sky, so you should check that out. That's actually in the current edition too, the March edition of, or is it the April edition? One of those editions has this review. Go check it out. But also, the Sydney Siege Hostage Survivor on how Jesus teaches her to love her neighbour, and in this case, her enemy. Louisa Hope and her mother were two of the hostages in the Lindt Cafe siege in Sydney in December 2014, when a lone gunman held 18 people hostage for 16 hours. Three people, including the gunman, were killed in the incident. And Louisa is now the ambassador for a new Love Thy Neighbor campaign by Common Grace and the Bible Society. So actually go to Eternity's Facebook page, look under videos, you'll see this amazing account of what was going on there. And also this tense idea of how do you love your enemy.
Very fitting when we're talking about Eye in the Sky. Still to come on the show, what we're going to be talking about in this special Easter edition of the program. Not only do we have Batman versus Superman, but we do have the top five Jesus on screen, as well as what does Australian culture make of this Easter caper? Welcome back to the special Easter Sunday edition of The Big Picture, where we've still got to come, stuff like Top 5 Jesus and a little movie you might like to call Batman versus Superman. That review is coming your way very quickly, shortly after I stop talking now.
Okay, but first we're going to do the press record segment. Now, press record is a chance where we actually take the pressure off ourselves and get other people to be smart for us. Okay.
That's so great, isn't it?
No.
I love
Seriously,
that part of the
it's
show.
It's hard to be smart each week.
You can tell by the way we talk.
You can tell how hard it is. Okay, Easter Sunday, a time to celebrate? Well, what exactly? In Australia, what is it that we think we're doing every year when a bumper long weekend coincides with Easter eggs? And oh, you know, Jesus. Ben interviewed Natasha Moore from the Centre for Public Christianity for our press record segment this week to understand exactly what Australian culture thinks about Easter. A leading hub of commentary, CPX, we love to turn to these guys for the deep thoughts and how Christianity actually fits in with where we live.
Well, I think Easter's a really interesting holiday, actually. It's a bit of an anomaly in the Australian calendar. So, you know, Christmas is really significant for everyone, whether believers or not. You know, it has a whole apparatus around it with the trees and the presents of Santa Claus and everything, whether you're a church goer or whether you believe in Jesus or not. Whereas Easter doesn't have as much consumerism around it. It doesn't have that much attached to it apart from the Christian story of Jesus' death and resurrection. But we still, you know, have this long weekend. It's a four-day weekend, and I think everybody's probably happy about that.
So what do you think most people in Australia are thinking? Are they just purely thinking, oh, it's Easter, therefore a long weekend, and they don't really associate much of the Christian story with it at all?
Yeah, I think the impression that we get at the Centre for Public Christianity is that lots of people actually really don't know this story. Lots of people think they do. We live in some ways a post-Christian country, and lots of people assume they know this story, but probably actually have never really heard it told. That being said, church attendance does go up significantly at Easter, so about 8% of Australians attend church on a regular basis, week by week. But at Easter, you know, we don't have exact figures, but anecdotally at least, church attendance goes up by up to 50%.
You just mentioned we seem to be living in a post-Christian society, which would mean that at one time we were more of a Christian society. So if you're casting our minds back, say, 40, 50 years ago, do you think Australians had the same attitude to Easter as they do now?
I think certainly the religious element to it used to be a stronger feature than it is. I mean, in the last census in 2011, still more than 60% of Australians will tick some kind of box that indicates that they consider themselves Christian, and yet not anything like that many people attend church. So I think that part of what's happened is that people used to kind of go to church by default because that's how they were brought up, and I think that happens a lot less now. So people may still kind of feel some sort of affiliation. So I think things are clearer demographically than they used to be.
Now, you guys at the Center for Public Christianity are really big on getting the good news of Jesus out to everybody, particularly those who don't yet know this good news. And this Easter, like other Easters in the past and Christmas times in the past, you're probably going to get some articles published on like the Sydney Morning Herald and the ABC trying to get the good news out there for everybody. Why do you guys do that? So, like, what kind of impact are you hoping to have?
Well, a couple of reasons. I mean, partly we really want to be saying to people that Christianity still is relevant to modern life. It still has something to contribute to the public sphere. And we think, especially at Easter, it's an appropriate time to remind people about some of the legacy that this story has given to Western culture. So really, the Easter story in particular is a story that's formed us. It's a story that gives us the idea that all humans are equal, all humans are valuable, that in the West we've believed for thousands of years, most people, that if God became human and gave up his life for humans, that that's because we're all very valuable, and that's had a huge impact on how we as a culture think that we ought to treat the marginalised and the kinds of social institutions and social systems that we have. So we want to kind of remind people of that heritage, but we also want to present to people kind of the truth and beauty of good and the goodness of this old story, and suggest that actually maybe there's something here that they've overlooked. It's a story of hope in the face of death, that really maybe there's something more out there. There's hope and joy in the face of possible despair. So we want to be kind of bringing that story to people afresh. And I think Easter is a time when maybe they're more open to hearing it.
Well, Mark, it had to happen. The movie showdown of the century. Yes, we're talking about the battle between Marvel Studios and DC Comics. DC Comics is the home of such iconic superheroes as Superman, Batman, The Flash, Aquaman, Fantastic Four. I mean, they're iconic, but their movies have been pretty lame. Anyway, let's move on. But it's been having its lunch money stolen by Marvel Studios, which is pretty much the Disney Studios, but in a mask up on the big screen, for the last 5 years at least, thanks to the big screen success of movies like Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, and the rest of the Avengers and all their various franchises. But the release this week of Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, was supposed to settle the score. Maybe even put DC back on top. Mark was there as the Caped Crusader took on the Man of Steel in a battle of spiritual proportions, the man-made hero versus the god from Krypton.
This bat vigilante is like a one-man reign of terror. You don't get to decide what the right thing is. Nobody cares about Clark Kent taking on the Batman.
This means something. It's all some people have. It's all that gives them hope.
People hate what they don't understand. Be their hero, Clark. Be their angel. Be their monument. Be anything they need you to be. Or be none of it. You don't owe this world a thing. You never did.
Batman vs. Superman is epic. There's no other word for it. It's just basically huge. It's probably the first film in ages that will actually be worth the $20+ you're going to pay to go see it in a VMAX cinema. And honestly,
mate, you would actually pay for this movie?
Well, if I was the sort of person who paid for tickets...
Get down from your ivory film reviewing
I'm
tower.
I'm just saying, if I had to... Now, this is how I actually judge whether or not a film is really worth seeing. Would I put my own money down? This, you've got to go see it in a VMAX screen. This is just built for big screens. This Titanic struggle is basically a part two to The Man of Steel. So Superman, Henry Cavill, has settled into the role of world savior and is flying around doing good on every continent. However, his to-the-rescue moments often involve a lot of collateral damage and things like that going on.
He's the guy playing Superman?
That's right, Henry Cavill. Well, Bruce Wayne, Ben Affleck, okay, let's say basically Batman for everyone, is afraid that the actions of this godlike superhero, left unchecked, will lead to world tyranny. So Gotham Bat Vigilante decides to take the modern-day savior down. Or does he? You see, you're not really sure whether or not this is a personal thing until suddenly you realize that behind the scenes is Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor pulling the strings, a manic millionaire who can't stand the idea that the brains can't actually equal power, and so he's prepared to put the two greatest heroes in the ground to prove that he can actually be on top. So there's an absolute stack of superhero reveals, comic book tie-ins, and yes, the promise of a sequel. Come on, that is not in any way a giveaway, people.
No way. It was
the dawn of justice.
That is not a spoiler.
But you won't hear any spoilers from me because I've been criticized too roundly for it on the show before. And I'll say it's great to finally see DC Comics take Marvel to the mat. That's what you're going to see.
Right. Man, you are clearly impressed with this film, which is very surprising given you've often been a critic of Ben Affleck on this program.
And I still am. I've got my I don't like Ben Affleck t-shirt.
Let's never talk about Argo, the film that he directed and won Oscars that? Years ago. Let's not talk about
Why
that.
Why spoil the moment?
Please move on.
Okay. It is true. Ben Affleck has no real talent. Okay. But he's kind of like...
He directed Gone Baby Gone, which is a fantastic film.
Directed,
yes.
I'm talking about acting.
Acting-wise, okay.
He's not so much Harrison Ford, okay? That he is the same character in every film. So if you like Ben Affleck in this film, you'll like him in every Ben Affleck film because he doesn't... Even when he's playing a Mexican, let's not mention Argo, you know, he's basically still exactly the same person. Okay, but that doesn't detract from this film because, to be honest, he does not a bad Batman. In fact, there's some incredible Bat moments that he carries off I think are really, really good. I had my doubts. You know, The Dark Knight was really good. But basically, DC Comics isn't fighting to go head-to-head with Marvel in this. You know, Marvel usually does the sort of kid's spectacular crash and bang followed by the one-liner, you know, humorous take. And Marvel is taking Batman vs. Superman into the region of the
DC.
DC is taking Batman vs. Superman into the realm of the Dark Knight.
The more serious, the more brooding, the
much
more
darker, much grittier. Dawn of Justice is clearly, you know, going to be trying to aim for that market, and I think it's going to do it well.
Right, and it is the first shot in what DC is going to be hoping will counter Marvel's Avengers on screen. So it's not just eye candy. There's a lot more food for thought that's delivered by Batman vs. Superman.
Yeah, surprisingly, there is a lot in this film that's very relevant to a current issue of atheism versus theism. You know, do we believe
theism as in the belief in a god?
I was getting there.
Yes.
I do have to be explained, people. I should have subtitles. But basically, yeah, do we believe in no god, or do we believe, you know, the majority of the planet, in a god? Okay, so there is a current struggle, and this film takes it head on. Batman clearly represents those people who don't want the fate of humanity in the hands of some sort of semi-god, and Superman supporters are those who are happy to trust in a higher power. There are some moments in this film that are deliberately religious, like Superman in the middle of a crowd and everybody bending down and reaching out to touch him, and it's very much like the Pope arrived.
He often in the comics and on screen, Superman has been referred to as a Jesus, Messiah, Savior character, which is very fitting for our Easter Sunday program. So that again happens here often in Batman vs. Superman.
Absolutely. This is clearly pitched as a battle of wills. Is it going to be humanity's will that will rule our fate, or is it going to be some god from outer space who rules our fate? You know, and that's really what the film's all about.
So like what happened way back when, a couple of thousand years ago, when God actually came to Earth in the form of Jesus, in any way, shape or form in Batman vs. Superman, does God actually like turn up into the action, or is Superman really his stand-in in this case?
Yeah, look, Superman is his stand-in for the majority of the film, and then something interesting happens, which I'm not going to give away. But basically, God does get a presence. Jesse Eisenberg, who plays Lex Luthor, actually brings God right into the plot a couple of times, talking about how he can't stand the idea of God, because he realized a long time ago, according to him, that if God is all-powerful, then he's not all good. Or if he's all good, then he's not all powerful. And you know, the weird thing is, you get a certain degree of sympathy for Lex Luthor's character in this case, because it's clear, even though he's as mad as a hatter, that he actually has a broken background that sort of somehow produced all of this, and is God responsible for all of that? Should God have done something? And so it's a very familiar atheistic argument. And in the end, Superman is sort of the threat that he might be this godlike character who doesn't really care enough about us is actually averted by the fact that we make him more human. Now, I'm not giving anything away in the plot, but I've got to say that the argument is left standing. You know, God can't possibly be in control of this world, or he's not good. And then we go off on another direction altogether and concentrate on superheroes. So this is a theological film. I mean, this is a film that people are really...
I didn't expect that at all.
Yeah, they're going to have to ask God questions about this one.
Awesome. Well, if you'd like to see Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice, tickets went on sale last week. I think people are already queuing up or still queuing up to see it. It's a massive monster of a movie. You may even see Mark there, who's going to pay money for this, possibly.
I will.
To see it again.
Possibly. I might ask the distributor for another ticket.
It's rated M for intense sequences of violence and mature themes, plus one obvious lazy swear word. Thanks, Ben Affleck. And stars the aforementioned Affleck alongside Henry Cavill, Gal Gadot. You'll hear a lot more about her in the guise of Wonder Woman.
Not from us, you won't.
That's not giving too much away. Amy Adams, Jesse Eisenberg, Jeremy Irons, and plenty others are in this film. Swing or fly into a cinema near you to see that. If you also want to check out another review of Batman vs. Superman to get another Christian reviewer's perspective on this, check out what Russ Matthews has written at insights.uca.org.au. He agrees with you, Mark, on the theological front that there's plenty of God stuff coming from this film, but does he agree with Mark's overall enthusiasm and interpretation of the film? Find out insights.uca.org.au.
Still coming up in the show, we're actually going to take a look at what the Bible has to say about Easter eggs. Parents, tune in for this bit. I've got to say, it was really helpful sort of preparing my kids. And I've got to say, too, the five top Jesuses who've appeared in film, Ben's going to let you know. Welcome back, Ben and Mark here with the Big Pictures Easter Sunday special. So much stuff still to come up. Please hang in because you're going to listen to the top five Jesus performances of all time, according to Ben McKechnie. But before that...
Before we do that, we're going to hear a little bit about Easter eggs, Mark. Easter eggs, which isn't really a topic that I think we've ever discussed before on The Big Picture, but it is Easter Sunday, and it's hard to ignore the vast amount of chocolate that you ate today, and also the tinfoil that tends to obscure the resurrection of Jesus, people. The resurrection of Jesus is what we're meant to be celebrating today. But did you know that Christians are responsible for making Easter eggs popular? Well, stand by for Bible Society Australia CEO Greg Clark for the truth behind the chocolate.
Nehemiah chapter 8 verse 10 says, "Go and celebrate with a feast of rich foods and sweet drinks, and share gifts of food with people who have nothing prepared. This is a sacred day before our Lord." Well, which came first, the chocolate or the egg? The answer in this case is easy. It was the egg. The original Easter eggs were hen or duck eggs, decorated in bright colours, but unlikely to keep today's children very happy. And Christians from the earliest times were very often happy to adapt the rituals and symbols of other worldviews, and the Easter egg is just that. It's the ancient symbol of fertility that's been repurposed by Christians. I guess nowadays it's getting depurposed from its Christian connection, as fewer and fewer people are aware that Easter is all about commemorating the death of Jesus and his resurrection to new life, hence the egg, with a promise of new life and forgiveness of sins for those who believe in him. Well, the beauty of the egg at Easter time was that during the period known as Lent in the medieval church calendar, people weren't supposed to eat eggs. So having an egg was a celebration of the end of the period of preparation for Easter week. The chocolate bit of it arrived in the 17th century as it became a popular food with which to celebrate the end of Lent's fasting. Well, you won't find chocolate mentioned in the Bible, but you will find plenty of references to sweetness and pleasure and feasting. Take our Bible verse from Nehemiah, for example. That verse was an instruction given to the people of Israel after they'd rediscovered the law of God following a period of exile. They were overwhelmed to know again about God and his ways. And what was the best way to respond to that? Choice food and drink. If they'd had chocolate, no doubt it would have come out for dessert. And that's the right way to respond to knowing what God is all about. And so at Easter, when we hear about Jesus' death and resurrection, giving thanks with some celebratory chocolate makes a lot of sense to me. But one complaint I have is this. In order to really enjoy the immense pleasure of the Lent-ending egg, you're supposed to wait until Lent actually ends. And that's on Easter Sunday. So for greater anticipation and enjoyment, save your chocolate indulgence until then. That's very hard to do when the shops start stocking Easter eggs straight after Christmas, and another sign of how our society has lost some of the beautiful rhythm that the Christian faith can give it.
Mark, we've come to the big finale of The Big Picture, the Easter Sunday special edition. And what better way to do that than to talk about the bloke who we talk about on Easter Sunday? We should be talking about him most days of the year, but of course on Easter Sunday, we talk about Jesus.
Absolutely.
And so what better way to finish The Big Picture than on the top five list, as we always do. And so this week, we're going to do the top five Jesus on screen. Now, I should point out, for anyone who hasn't looked into this, and you can quickly do this by going on to IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, type in the word Jesus, and go to the character page, and you'll find that there's a roughly 636 appearances on screen by Jesus or people playing Jesus.
And this week, Ben looked at all of them.
As far as I know, there wasn't, you know, people running around with cameras at the time taking footage of Jesus.
Rounded it out and maybe only looked at 200 or 300.
So I did. I scanned across 636 appearances, and this is what I came up with.
Five.
Willem Dafoe from 1988, very controversial, The Last Temptation of Christ.
Okay. Well, what about Willem's performance caught your eye?
Mate, I think a lot of people just know this because of the controversy. Martin Scorsese directed this film, caused a huge stink in the late 80s about how it was presenting Jesus on screen. Why I've chosen it is because I think Willem Dafoe, like plenty of others in this list I'm going to reference, but I think Willem Dafoe, somewhat in particular, was very good at demonstrating the humanity and the everydayness of Jesus. That was a big intent of this film anyway, not necessarily to bring Jesus right back down to our level entirely, but I think a lot of the God element was taken out of the Jesus character, and Willem Dafoe was instead showing him as more this kind of earthy, good-natured, but quite stoic and very thoughtful individual roaming around on the earth. And then one of the things that was so controversial about the film and why it's called The Last Temptation of Christ is that Willem Dafoe's performance, as good as it was, verges on that often on suggesting that Jesus potentially could have been sinful or could have given in to temptations that they create on screen. If you go to the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, you'll see that there's a lot in Last Temptation of Christ that didn't actually happen. But the suggestions that Jesus could potentially be sinful is why a lot of people will stay away from Last Temptation of Christ. But Willem Dafoe's performance, humanity really stands out.
Okay.
Now we go to the other side of the equation. With Jesus' performance on screen, Mark, we've talked about this before on The Big Picture. Actors, when they come to play Jesus on screen, they often can tend to go one of two ways. Then go the Willem Dafoe way, the much more human side of Jesus. You paint that side. Or you go in this other direction, number four, Max von Sydow in The Greatest Story Ever Told from 1965. This excellent Swedish actor playing Jesus more on the reverent, heavenly, distant to us, very detached side. I remember Max von Sydow's performance mainly because it struck me as being Jesus, as everything he said was profound and deep, which pretty much is what everything Jesus said.
He almost did set the caricature of Jesus.
He did.
Screen.
It becomes a bit of a caricature, even though it's not. And I think he was genuinely into it. And Max von Sydow himself said playing the role of Christ was like being in a prison, and it was the hardest part he's ever had to play in his life. And because he couldn't smoke or drink in public, so he had to repress his humanness so much. That's what he felt about being Jesus, that he kind of verged the other way. So as very reverential as that performance is, which is why it's coming in at number four, what it can suffer from, I think, and this prison quote of Max von Sydow's, I think, demonstrates that, is he can sort of imprison the humanity of Jesus. And as plenty of people know who follow and love and give their life to Jesus, they know Jesus was both human and God, and the two shouldn't be separated out.
Not less of either, yeah.
Not less of either. This is an interesting choice, and I pretty much picked it at number three because it's interesting. I didn't go down the route of Life of Brian, the Monty Python film, and I didn't talk about the guy who played Jesus in that. I could have, but I didn't. Instead, for this more novel choice, and I'm still trying to be reverent about Jesus, Victor Garber in 1973's Godspell, because in the 70s, there was like at least three musicals that were released about Jesus. Jesus Christ Superstar, which I have no idea why that thing became so popular. I think that's it's a pretty lame musical, let alone a pretty tragic telling of Jesus on screen in terms of misunderstanding what he was about and what he came to do. And Johnny Cash also in the 70s released The Gospel Road. But Godspell, Victor Garber, 1973. The main reason I picked this is something of the novelty, but once you see past that, Godspell was all about being set in New York City. It was very countercultural. It focused largely on the parables of Jesus from the book of Matthew. And I think it showed the humorous, the playful side, but also the storytelling side, the artistic, the creative side of Jesus as well. And I think Victor Garber's performance in Godspell went some way to demonstrating that, even though Victor Garber himself pretty much didn't get anything out of the role apart from just saying, oh yeah, it was a good role to play. It's a bit sad, is that I think when you hear about guys who played Jesus up on screen, that the only thing they take from it is, well, it was either like a prison and I couldn't smoke and drink, or it just was a good role, but I went on to play it the rest of my career. Really? I'm very surprised that you wouldn't be more struck, when, especially if you're going around performing the parables of Matthew in the streets of New York City as a countercultural revolutionary. I thought that might have hit home a little bit deeper. Two. Coming at number two, have you seen from 1977, Jesus of Nazareth? It's a six-hour, right? It's like a mini-series movie that Robert Powers, the actor playing Jesus in that film. I haven't actually seen it, but I've read a lot about it.
I was actually in a hospital bed for 10 days and during this time watched this film.
What? It sounds like a story.
More stories for next week.
Sounds like a story for another time. On this Easter Sunday edition of The Big Picture, as we're talking about top five Jesus on screen, I went with a version of Jesus on screen I actually haven't seen, but read so much about. The main reason is that number two is because when people talk about actors playing Jesus on screen, Robert Powell, who isn't really a very well-known actor at all, actually a lot of the actors on this list, well, Victor Garber at number three isn't very well-known either, but Robert Powell, not so much. But his performance in 1977 was found notable by some people because things like he was instructed by his director to not blink when he was on screen for intensity.
It's actually somewhat freaky. It's just his visual performance is incredible.
Which I don't know. I don't remember reading any part of the gospel that said Jesus didn't blink. I'm not sure why that's needed for a performance. But I did read someone's interpretation of that was that it was meant to convey an air of messianic spirituality.
Yeah, it sort of creates this sort of somewhat separateness on the screen.
Yeah, but from what I understand, the performance, you've got the separateness, but you've also got the human suffering, the passion part of Jesus, the last week of his life leading up to what we celebrated Easter Friday. Friday and Easter Sunday, and the pain of his inner turmoil is also demonstrated on screen. So instead of the Willem Dafoe end or the Max von Sydow end of the spectrum, Robert Powell's coming much closer towards the middle. And I should also note that Robert Powell does believe in Jesus and his divinity, even though he doesn't necessarily go to church. But prior to being cast in the performance of the role of Jesus, his knowledge of Jesus was limited to Sunday school, and he went and read the Bible and the gospel accounts and actually came to be a follower of Christ, which is fantastic. He's at number two because number one is...
One.
Pretty obvious choice, really, Mark. 2004's The Passion of the Christ star Jim Caviezel, who played Jesus in that film.
He had to be in there somewhere.
He did. As brutal and shocking and confronting as that film is, and plenty of Christians and people who aren't Christian alike won't see that film, and fair enough, for good reason. It's very graphic and disturbing. But when we're talking about Easter Sunday and what led up to those events of the resurrection and the incredible good news of Jesus rising from the dead, defeating death, defeating sin, and offering forgiveness for our sins, taking punishment throughout everything he did for us, and then rising at the end to be triumphant and glorious and all of those kind of things. What led up to that? Well, those incredible events of Jesus being tortured, flogged, and put on the crucifix, which is demonstrated powerfully in The Passion of the Christ. But I picked Jim Caviezel at number one because, again, like Robert Powell, he seems to have this authentic, detailed, complex demonstration. Not just because he's talking in Aramaic, not just because he gets all bloodied and is all dirty, but there's a mix of the God and the man coming together on screen here, which is a remarkably powerful performance, particularly as it could have just been overruled entirely by the graphic violence that's going on around him.
Do you think that's because, like, he personally understood who it was he was trying to convey?
Yeah, I think it is. We're about to play a grab from Jim Caviezel when he was interviewed about his role on screen. And yes, I think as we get to the end of our top five list of Jesus performances on screen, a powerful thing about Jim Caviezel is his, and what he comes across on screen, I think, is his understanding of who Jesus is, what he came to do, and his personal, Jesus' personal impact on Jim Caviezel's sinful, broken, imperfect life.
At that point, I'm thinking about all my sins. The whole part was, you know, I'm not worthy to play this role.
Yeah.
And that's a good place to be in. I told a friend of mine that, and, you know, he says, well, you know, Jim, God doesn't always choose the best. But he chose you. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
So, you know, I was in a place of deep, just like in the zone.
Yeah.
And throughout the whole film, I was always meditating and always praying the whole time.
Mate, that brings us to a close of our Easter Sunday special. Great note to end on of someone championing the difference that Jesus has made in their life because of his death and resurrection and what that offers all of us.
Ah, something to contemplate.
Yeah.
Over more chocolate. Okay, coming up next week, a new TV show invites us to spice up our marriage by living with someone else.
Oh.
Yeah, figure that out.
Right. Should we spend 90 minutes in heaven, Mark? Find out next week.
And for something totally different that we desperately need to discuss, what are the movie sequels we actually wish someone would go and make? Next week.
Yeah, all that next week when still, as always, as this week and then and whenever, I'm going to be Ben McKechnie.
And I'm still Mark Hadley. Thanks for coming.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.